Hey guys, how's it going?
Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. I got a bunch of complaining to do for you today. It should be fun. And, yeah, dude, I got a couple of good interviews, too. Matthew Ho is going to be on to stick up for Bo Bergdahl a bit here. Where's that email from him? I need to get that open. Here we go. Bo Bergdahl, he's the guy who walked off base in Afghanistan, was captured by the Taliban, and now is going to be prosecuted for desertion. And Matthew Ho has some things he's going to say about that. Yeah, I might ask him a little bit about the Iraq War III, that is, as well. And then big doings down in Yemen today, last night and today. The Houthis, formerly known as the Houthi rebels, who really for the last few months have ruled the capital city of Sana'a, they chased the pseudo-president Hadi that America installed in power after driving their sock puppet Saleh out. Well, after the people drove Saleh out back a couple of years ago, had to flee the country. And so now they're saying the entire, every Sunni king and military dictator is now sending troops and planes to go and fight. So, again, the absurdity of trying to keep track of who all side America is on in this war. We fight for Iran in Iraq, but against them in Yemen and Syria. And, yeah, no, they still really haven't backed off supporting the Mujahideen in Syria, even after all this time. I'm not accusing them of directly supporting ISIS, but, de facto, pretty damn much. And they're still talking about trying to rebrand the al-Nusra Front to make them the moderates, so that they can back al-Qaeda in Syria. You can't make this stuff up. If I was making it up, you'd call me a kook, but it's true, so you can't. So Eric Margolies is going to be on to talk about Yemen, what's going on there, what we can expect from this war, and et cetera, like that. Last night was the second episode of Eye on the Empire, featuring myself and the great Jeff Tucker from Liberty.me. He is the chief Liberty officer of Liberty.me, and he and I host this show, Eye on the Empire. I think we're going to start doing it every 2 weeks, but not on Sunday, because Sunday is skateboard night, man. I mean, Wednesday is what I was trying to say. I don't know why Sunday came out of my mouth. Oh, the word Sunday is in front of my eyeballs. Got a short circuit in my brain. Wednesday night, that's skateboard night, man. So, hopefully last night will be the last time we do Eye on the Empire on a Wednesday. The boys all went and skated a pool last night, and I didn't get to go. But that's all right, because I had a great time talking with Jeff Tucker. He's really smart, that guy, man. And we were talking all about the new Asian Development Bank thing that the Chinese are setting up as a challenge to the American IMF, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the end of the empire. And, you know, business, big business, and their role in the empire, as compared to the power of the state, et cetera. And, it's pretty interesting stuff, man. Just stop by liberty.me. Or I think you can find it at Spreecast as well, if you want. Eye on the Empire, Episode 2, with Scott Horton and Jeffrey Tucker. You can find it there, liberty.me. Also, check out my archives, my interview archives, at scotthorton.org. I got more than 3,700 interviews now going back to 2003 at scotthorton.org. All of them for free in MP3 format for you if you want them. scotthorton.org. And by the way, join up the chat room. Hey, chat room guys, how the hell are you, man? Good to see you. Guys are hanging out in the chat room. It's an IRC free node chat room. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Or just go to scotthorton.org/chat in your browser window. Fake name and a captcha, and you're in there. And then you can talk with the boys, send me links, or tell me whether or not you can hear the birds cackling outside the window, or whatever it is. ScottHorton.org/chat, hashtag Scott Horton Show. And also, follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, I say lots of mean things to people there. Maybe to you. Okay, so now, let's see, in the next segment, I'm going to do the John Bolton article. So now, that's good, because that leaves me little time to talk about Rand Paul. And I don't want anything more than little time to talk about Rand Paul. I wish somehow I didn't have to ever talk about him ever again, but so much for that. So here's the headline. Boy, you can tell how tired of this I sound, huh? Here's the headline from Time Magazine. Rand Paul proposes boosting defense spending. This is not the story from the other day, where he was finding a loophole around the sequester and reallocating a little money here or there. Writes Time Magazine, Rand Paul's amendment would add $76.5 billion to the defense budget. That's right. Ron Paul's son is proposing a $76.5 billion increase in Pentagon spending. I got to read this thing. I don't have to read this thing. There you go. That's who he is. The excuse is that, oh, well, he's going to take the money out of foreign aid and global warming research and a bunch of crap. So what? And, of course, by foreign aid, he doesn't even mean it. I mean, he says, no, I want to suspend foreign aid to countries where they burn the American flag. Well, first of all, that's just a stupid talking point. The only country in the world where they sit around burning the American flag is in Iran, and we don't give foreign aid to Iran. He's pretending that he's talking about Egypt, but America pays Egypt to pretend to not hate Israel. That's why America gives billions of dollars a year to Egypt, is for Israel. And if you think that Rand Paul means to suspend foreign aid to Egypt so that they will continue to be the loyal sock puppet of the Israelis, then you're stupid. But as always, Rand Paul doesn't mean what he says. I mean, well, like Obama, if he says something horrible and evil, you can take it to the bank. But when he tries to put a positive spin on anything, you know it's a damned lie. And how does he help himself with this? By making himself just another Republican. Whose strategy is this? You know, it says in here, this is the same thing that Marco Rubio said last week. Paul's change of heart, yeah, right. On the budget highlights the importance of the funding document to many likely presidential candidates. In addition to the increased defense spending. Oh, no, I skipped the first Rubio sentence here. Wait a minute. I gotta go back to my earlier Rubio reference. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Oh, here. Paul's amendment brings him in line with his likely presidential primary rivals, including Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who introduced a measure calling for nearly the same level of increases just days ago. The amendment was first noticed by Time and later confirmed by Rand Paul's office. So there you go. It reminds me of what my friend Dave said, that, man, 2016 is going to suck so bad for libertarianism, man. There's whatever huge percentage of libertarians are going to demand that all the rest of us get on board to support this piece of crap, while he just drags the name of libertarianism through the mud, makes us all look like a bunch of conservatives. It's sickening. Ron Paul's, boy, can you believe it? Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know Your Enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. Coming up, Matthew Ho on Bo Bergdahl. Eric Margolies on Yemen. But now, John Bolton is in the New York Times today. I'll have to look that up in a minute. John Bolton is in the New York Times, former unconfirmed ambassador to the United Nations and State Department flunky. John Bolton, to stop Iran's bomb, bomb Iran. Oh, God, this is about as tiresome as Rand Paul. Well, so let's just go through and I'll debunk all the assertions in here because none of them are true. For years, experts worried that the Middle East would face an uncontrollable nuclear arms race if Iran ever acquired weapons capability. Given the region's political, religious, and ethnic conflicts, the logic is straightforward. Okay, well, but what does he mean by capability? Iran has had the ability to enrich uranium since 2005. They had the fuel cycle, quote-unquote, mastered since, what, 07, 08 at the latest? They've had a nuclear weapons capability for years on end now. Where's the Saudi nuclear weapons program? Oh, Christ, Scott Horton, you just debunked the entire John Bolton article in your first comment on the first paragraph. Can we all go and take a nap now? As in other proliferation cases like India, Pakistan, and North Korea, America and the West were guilty of inattention when they should have been vigilant. Well, that's not true. America helped India and Pakistan both with their nuclear weapons program, and it was John Bolton himself who pushed North Korea, well, I mean, under George Bush's orders, who pushed North Korea out of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and their safeguards agreement with the IAEA and helped them to decide that making nuclear weapons was the only way to protect themselves from invasion. If you don't believe that, just go read How Bush Pushed North Korea to Nukes by the great Gordon Prather. Eh, long story short, they lied about pretending that the North Koreans said they had a secret uranium enrichment program when they never did. They created an extra legal proliferation security initiative, which was just their assertion of the right to seize North Korean vessels on the high seas, and spelled seas two different ways there. Bush and his lackeys piled on all the insults against Kim Jong-il. Oh, I loathe him. He's a pygmy and all this kind of crap. Not that George W. Bush is a bigot or anything. Calling Kim Jong-il a pygmy. But then it was the sanctions. They put on layers and layers of sanctions and they outright renounced the agreed framework deal from 1994 that America never lived up to in the first place. And only then did North Korea leave the Non-Proliferation Treaty and begin making nukes out of plutonium, not uranium. And yes, they have a uranium program now, but there's no evidence it existed back in 2002 when Bolton and his lackeys lied and said that they admitted that they had one. Okay, so then he says, but failing to act in the past is no excuse for the same mistakes now. All presidents enter office facing the cumulative effects of their predecessors' decisions, but each is responsible for what happens on his watch. Obama's approach on Iran has brought a bad situation to the brink of catastrophe. What was the bad situation? That Bush refused to negotiate with them when they wanted to negotiate back in 2003. Before they had a single spinning centrifuge. Refused to negotiate with them in 2005. 3 through 5, when he just sent the Europeans to negotiate on America's behalf with a simple demand: you must give up your entire nuclear program or die. So they didn't. And then they layered on sanction after sanction after sanction. Bush threatened the Iranians: you better not vote for the right winger, in July of 2005, which just guaranteed the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And then they layered on pile of sanctions after pile of sanctions, which only encouraged the Iranians to continue to expand their civilian safeguarded nuclear enrichment capability. All right. In theory, sanctions rigorously enforced and universally adhered to might have broken the back of Iran's nuclear program. Really? And what's the evidence for that? Nothing. As I just said, they didn't have even a single spinning centrifuge. Bush and then Obama put layers and layers and layers of sanctions on them, and all they did was expand their program and expand their program until Obama finally decided to deal with them and get the interim agreement. And only then have they begun to scale back their enrichment. So what is the evidence for his assertion that, in theory, sanctions might have broken the back of Iran's nuclear program? Nothing. And under what even make-believe scenario were they going to just say, okay, fine, we'll just not have a nuclear program anymore, if you say so? Give me a break. How did this even get past their editor? They didn't send him back and say, could you please explain, like, even a partial argument for why we should believe this to be true at all? But the sanctions imposed have not met those criteria. No, they're crippling sanctions. And the United Nations is helping to enforce them and everything else. But no, they're just not severe enough, I guess. And the president, as he says, the president's own director of national intelligence testified in 2014 that the sanctions have not stopped Iran's processing its nuclear, progressing its nuclear program. Right. Yeah, exactly. Then Bolton says there is now widespread acknowledgement that the rosy 2007 national intelligence estimate, which judged that Iran's weapons program was halted in 2003, was an embarrassment, little more than wishful thinking. No, there is not widespread acknowledgement of that. Just a plain, outright, damned lie. In fact, the CIA in 2010, 11, 12, and including last year, 2014, have reaffirmed their position that the Iranians do not have a nuclear weapons program. All they ever had before 03 was some small research projects, not a nuclear weapons program at all. And the CIA and the entire National Intelligence Council's position is that they still stand by the National Intelligence Estimate of 2007. And guess who agrees with them? Israeli Mossad. You can go look it up in Haaretz right now. They even adopt the CIA's exact language, that we assess that the Iranians have not made the political decision to begin to make nuclear weapons. They have not decided to even try. There's widespread acknowledgement inside John Bolton's imagination, and maybe over at the pages of Commentary magazine. Again, the New York Times editors have no problem with him making this ridiculous assertion, when all you have to do is just look at James Risen's reporting in the New York Times from 2012 that says intelligence agencies see no move toward a bomb. Oh, and hell, I already ran out of time, huh? Well, anyway, there's not another damn piece of this that's true. So this is what the War Hawks have. Nothing. Just lies. Pure lies. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, all Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I've got Matthew Ho. He is senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. And he used to work for the State Department. And then, I forget, Matthew, you were a Marine before that, is that right? Welcome back.
Hey, Scott, how you doing? Yeah, that's correct.
Right. And then you resigned in protest over the Afghan surge back in 2009, 2010?
Yes, correct. In 2009, I was working for the State Department as a political officer in Afghanistan. And, after serving twice in Iraq and seeing the war in Afghanistan and realizing this is the same thing as occurred in Iraq, just, couldn't go along with it any longer.
Okay, right on. So now we got your bio straight. Let's talk about Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. Who's Sergeant Bo Bergdahl?
Well, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is a young man, or at least he was a young man 5 years ago before he was captured by the Taliban in Afghanistan. He was a young man from Idaho, joined the Army, became a paratrooper, went to Afghanistan in the spring of 2009 with his unit. And after a short while there, just a couple of months after being there, he disappeared. He left his base. They were in eastern Afghanistan, a difficult part of Afghanistan, very dangerous for American forces, a stronghold of the insurgency, a stronghold of the Taliban and the Pashtun insurgency. And he was, within a couple of days, was realized he had been captured by the insurgency. He had been captured by some element of the insurgency and turned over to the Haqqani network. And that thus began a 5-year confinement for him, where he was repeatedly tortured. As we are now learning, he tried to escape 12 times. And in the spring of last year, about 10 months ago, the United States was able to win his release by conducting a prisoner swap. We provided the insurgency in Afghanistan back with 5 of their people who were holding Guantanamo Bay, and they gave us back Sergeant Bergdahl. And it became, of course, this media firestorm, most of it politically motivated. However, Sergeant Bergdahl's fellow soldiers came out very publicly and forcibly saying he was a deserter and should not be treated as a hero. Sergeant Bergdahl spent the last 10 months in recovery down in San Antonio, Texas, as well as working a desk job. And just yesterday, the Army issued a charge sheet against Sergeant Bergdahl for two charges, one for desertion and the other for misbehavior before the enemy. That last charge is a very broad, wide catch-all. That I tell you what, Scott, every single one of us who served overseas could be found guilty of some part of that, because you'd have to be Audie Murphy to not be in violation of that charge. But it's a catch-all. You can pin anything on anyone for it. But that's where it stands now. And one of the things that is for those of us who, and I'm a friend of Sergeant Bergdahl's family. I became friendly with his parents while he was in captivity for those 5 years. One of the things that's always been said about this from the family, from the attorneys, from those who are familiar with the investigation, is that there's much more to this than just Sergeant Bergdahl abandoning his mates, of rejecting his oath and fleeing to the enemy. And as we saw, with the most detail we've seen so far, his attorneys have been very tight-lipped. They've been saying they do not want to try this case in the media. But in the most revelatory fashion we've seen so far, in a letter that his attorney furnished yesterday to the media, we learned that the report, this 10-month investigation, backs up this assertion that Sergeant Bergdahl didn't willy-nilly decide to quit the war, that he wasn't rushing to aid the enemy or join the Taliban, but rather his motives were pure, and that he did not have any bad intentions. And that's directly from the report. that he had no intention of deserting permanently, that this was a temporary leaving of his post, that he had no intentions of leaving the army, had no intentions of joining the Taliban, had no intentions of assisting the enemy. And most importantly, the report states that Sergeant Bergdahl left his post to communicate with the closest American general officer, the closest American general, about disturbing circumstances that were occurring. And this goes back to some things I had learned from Michael Hastings and from Matt Farwell, who had written the Rolling Stone article mm-hmm. about Sergeant Bergdahl a few years ago, that something was amiss here. Something was not right. And the belief that he knew information, that something had occurred that had caused him to lose faith in the mission, lose faith in his comrades. And now we see that quite possibly the reason why he did leave the base and ultimately was captured and tortured for 5 years was that he was trying to report a wrongdoing, trying to report some type of crime, trying to report some type of illegal activity by his unit. And this squares, Scott, with our understanding and our knowledge that that entire unit, the entire brigade out there, was required to sign non-disclosure agreements when they returned from Afghanistan, which is incredibly unique. These guys are not special operations forces. This is not intelligence officers. These are just common Joes, just regular soldiers. And for them to have to sign non-disclosure agreements was always kind of a flag to a lot of people. And now this makes sense. And so I think what we're going to see unravel as Sergeant Bergdahl's charges go to the Article 32 hearing, which is basically a grand jury investigation, and then ultimately may proceed to court-martial or trial, is that something was going on here that much deeper and much more sinister than Bo Bergdahl just deciding to quit the war, that things occurred out on that frontier that he saw, he witnessed, that he could not abide by, and that he listened to his conscience and ultimately got himself captured that way.
All right. Now, so there's a lot to unpack and go over there and follow up and all these kinds of things. First of all, I forget now if it was from Michael Hastings' report. I think it was from Hastings' piece in Rolling Stone, something about how he had witnessed a kid run over yep. by an American truck. And this was something that had really bothered him, and the rest of the crew were all joking about it and didn't care, but it really bothered him. Is that what you think was the, you know, one of the things or the thing that he was so concerned about? Or it sounds like you kind of sound like you're implying that there was something, you know, much more nefarious going on than just a couple of measly collateral damage casualties.
Yeah, I think so. It may be. I mean, this was a young man. He was 22 years old at the time. He had been in combat, you know, I mean, so it just may, and I don't want to say just may have been just one kid getting run over by a truck, which is terrible itself, but it may have been that. It may have been more.
Yeah, I don't mean to diminish it. I'm just being sarcastic.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with this guy. You know, we do know that. We know it from the emails that were disclosed between him and his family, that he was concerned about things that occurred like that. And so I think very well that would have been the impetus for him to feel he had to act out. He had to obey his conscience and he had to obey his responsibilities as a soldier. I mean, it's interesting in this country. We are so quick to cite the Nuremberg principles, right? That following orders is not an excuse to commit wrongdoing. But when it comes to actually carrying out the principles of Nuremberg, we don't see it occur very often. And when we do, it's often vilified.
Right.
So
the American courts have refused to uphold the principle that enlisted men have the right to defy their officers if they think their orders are illegal. Your orders are legal because the Constitution says you better obey the chain of command, boy, and that's all that counts, say the American courts at this point. So you'd still get court-martialed anyway if you invoked Nuremberg. But now the music's playing. We got to take this break. Okay. We'll be right back with Matthew Ho, talk more about the case of Bo Bergdahl, who will be prosecuted for desertion, the military announced yesterday. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Matthew Ho about Bo Bergdahl, who the military announced yesterday they are going to prosecute him for desertion. Now, Matthew, let me make sure I understand this right. It was his lawyer, or it was the government statement that said that, well, actually it wasn't desertion. He was going off to try to find a superior officer from another chain of command somewhere where he could tell the truth to someone, as opposed to, oh, he decided he was going to hike to China.
Yeah, this is revealed by his lawyer attesting to what the report found. So unless his attorneys are perjuring themselves in a legal document and lying about what you can read black and white in an official Army investigation, this is what the Army concluded. This is what the command, the general who oversees the investigation concluded that.
Well, no, but if I leave, if somebody leaves their command to go find another U.S. Army unit, how the hell do you pretend for a moment that that counts as desertion?
It's, you know, if, and I encourage people to read, His legal team's letter. You can find it on PBS.org has it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, Scott, because that's exactly the crux of his letter, and that by the nature of it, this should not be desertion. It really should be unauthorized absence if you want to charge him with anything. But there's also something, too, that shows the pedantic and petty nature of the Army bureaucracy. In his response to the Army, his attorneys, Bergdahl's attorneys, talk about how the Army is considering revoking his prisoner of war status, not because of anything Bergdahl did, but because the Army bureaucracy failed to conduct a board of inquiry. So that because administratively Bergdahl wasn't declared a prisoner of war correctly, because as he says, as the lawyers say, the T's weren't crossed, the I's weren't dotted, that the Army actually considers it a good idea. The same people who want to charge him with desertion, knowing full well that he did, just as you said, leave to go and report the truth about what was occurring to another unit, to another superior officer, they want to recall his prisoner of war status and all the benefits and everything that would entail because of an administrative mistake, a clerical mistake, by the Army itself. So that's the type of people you're dealing with here. That's the and anyone who's served, anyone who's been in, you know, I was in the Marine Corps 10 years, anyone who's spent time in the military will understand that mindset.
Amazing. Yeah, well, I've read Catch 22. Does that count?
Yeah, that's Scott, there's no – people ask me all the time, what's the best book written about war? And I say Catch 22. That or I think it was Joseph Hooker's book, MASH, that they made the film and the TV series about.
Yeah.
Same type of thing. Explains it perfectly.
Complete absurdity.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a great book by Mises called Bureaucracy. That's, yeah, pretty much explains what we're talking about there. All right, now, so now what about all this, all the American soldiers who died out looking for this guy? How careless was he to go and get himself captured by the enemy, and then all of his comrades end up getting shot up and blown up going to try to save him?
Well, again, according to his legal team, the report that the Army conducted in this, the 10-month investigation that they did, plus the 5 years he was in captivity, there is no evidence that any American soldiers were killed looking for Bo Bergdahl. What killed those American soldiers, like the other 2,200 that were killed in Afghanistan, was the war. What killed those young men was that they were put in eastern Afghanistan to accomplish a mission that was a fantasy, to accomplish a mission that had no purpose, to win a war that was unwinnable. So the responsibility for their deaths lies not on a young man who was trying to obey his conscience and then was captured by the insurgency, but rather with a chain of command that went along with a war that was absurd and without point, an administration that escalated the war because it made great political sense, and an American public that, even though they disliked the war by large amounts, I mean, this is, according to various polls, the most unpopular war in American history, has not really stood up and said, hey, we should stop our kids dying there. We should stop our kids killing other people's kids. We should stop wasting trillions of dollars on this.
Right. And on one point here, it's a little bit of a tangent, but it's an important point that you made there. About the unwinnable nature of this and how the politicians in D.C. knew this. There's a report, there's a book by a Washington Post reporter called Little America, and they excerpted it in the Washington Post, and they report in there that the CIA did an intelligence estimate. Well, I don't know if it was officially a national intelligence estimate, but it was a CIA report that told Obama, don't bother surging into Afghanistan back in 2009. It won't work. So don't do it, or don't, you know, well, I don't know if it was specific advice, but anyway, here's why there's no reason to believe that the surge could possibly be successful, sir. And Obama knew what it said and then chose deliberately to not read it so that he would have plausible deniability, so that he could pretend that he was ignorant, that the CIA warned him that the whole thing was pointless, because, as you said, it was good politics to give in to Petraeus and McChrystal and Bill Kristol and escalate that war.
Absolutely. You know, and that's, I got, when I first met Dan Ellsberg after I resigned and came home and then became this celebrity or whatever, right? When I first met Dan Ellsberg, the first thing he said to me, Dan Ellsberg, of course, the U.S. government official, RAND policy person who published the Pentagon Papers at great risk to his personal safety and liberty. But Dan, the first thing Dan said to me was, asked me, was like, did you bring any documents with me? And at the time when I resigned, I was quitting. I was done with the wars. I had no thought that I'd be here 5.5 years later, you know, talking on the radio about this. And now I realize I should have brought things. I mean, again, I had no intention of being an outspoken opponent, or, I mean, this is all, you know. But looking back, if I did have a time, I would have, because there were things that were available. And it was in September of 2009 or October 2009. The Boston Globe, to its credit, published a leak assessment of the insurgency in Afghanistan that found that 9 out of 10 Taliban are fighting us because we're there. They're not fighting us because of their religion or because of some type of ideology or allegiance to the Taliban, but because we were there and because we were backing this corrupt government that was predatory, that was taking advantage of them. And these were the reasons why I resigned. Unfortunately, when I left for good and didn't bring any of my emails, didn't bring any documents, didn't bring anything to show that, yes, this is exactly what our assessment was. And interesting enough, Scott, this may be one of the reasons why, when General McChrystal took command in Afghanistan in 2009 and he did his famous assessment, did his famous survey, he didn't utilize U.S. military officers. He didn't utilize U.S. diplomats or U.S. intelligence officers, these people that we spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year on training and educating and growing. What he did was he went and brought in outside experts from think tanks and places that were sympathetic to the idea of escalation of war, of empire, of having this large American intervention overseas, who believed in counterinsurgency, that you could that it believed in the magic of it, for lack of a better phrase. He brought in those people who would rubber stamp, you know, expanding the war and trying this philosophy, this alchemy of counterinsurgency. And so, yeah, I mean, you could see that if he had done it through the military, through the intelligence services, it wouldn't have received the glaring endorsement that it did through basically private contractors.
Yeah. All right. Now, so last couple of minutes here, back to Bergdahl. What's going to happen to him? How much time is he facing? I guess I read he's even facing possibly the death penalty. Is that correct?
Yeah, the army waived off that, the death penalty, but so the maximum he could receive is life in prison. How he could receive life in prison, if the facts as reported in the report are correct, how could he even be charged if the facts in the report are correct? I am unsure. But you'd have to believe, if he is charged, if he is found guilty, that some leniency would be shown, particularly as he was held prisoner in terrible conditions, tortured horribly for 5 years, made 12 separate escape attempts, that some leniency would have to be shown by the U.S. government, the U.S. Army, in its sentence.
Now, what can be done here? I mean, can you testify as an expert witness? Who's going to defend this kid?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure how that's going to happen. His legal team has been very quiet about this case. Again, they've said all along they're not going to try it out in the court of public opinion. They're not going to go to the media. His lead attorney was on the media yesterday. You could see a good interview with him on PBS and NPR as well as MSNBC. Mm-hmm. But hopefully more people speak out about this, and hopefully maybe we get a few strong-willed and brave people in Congress who recognize that there's something very wrong here, and this young man may actually be a hero.
Yeah. All right, y'all, that's Matthew Ho. Thank you very much for your time on this subject.
Hey,
here.
Scott. Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back with Eric Margolese, y'all. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And lucky you and me, I got the great Eric Margolese on the line. He's the author of War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. He's covered 14 wars. He's been all around the world 100 times. And he knows everything about everything. And he's good on it, too. Welcome back to the show, Eric. How are you?
I'm happy to be back with you. We're struggling with all the news today. I'm about to write my weekly column. And there's too much news today. Most of it's bad.
Kind of hard to narrow it down, right?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me mention the website you write for, ericmargolese.com. Spell it like Margolis, ericmargolese.com. Also, find him at lourockwell.com and at unz.com. That's U-N-Z, unz.com. Now, so we got to talk about Yemen. I guess, well, we've been talking about Yemen for quite a while now, well, years, but even in the last few months, about the Houthi Shiite takeover of the capital city of Sana'a. And I guess I don't even really understand sort of the slow motion effect going on here. They've announced that, oh no, the capital has fallen to the Houthis like four different times, even though they already took the thing over months and months ago. But I guess it's really come to a head, and the American sock puppet so-called President Hadi had to flee the country yesterday, and then, blam, war broke out. All the headlines say, I think, that every Sunni king has now declared war on Yemen, and there are pictures of huge explosions in the capital city and anti-aircraft fire, and they say that even the Libyans and the Sudanese and everybody else are going to come and invade and kill these Houthis dead. Is that right? What in the world is going on?
Well, you know, I've been going to Yemen since the mid-1970s, and I've always very fond of it. It's a wild and crazy place, just creeping into the 11th century and filled with trigger-happy tribesmen who love nothing better than to shoot the place up and have little wars and pillage and run around and then in the afternoon chew the favorite narcotic in the country, which is called khat. And everybody gets stoned every afternoon. So it's a combination of stoners and gunmen.
Well, that sounds kind of mutually exclusive, you know? I don't know. Usually stoners like to just sit back and hang out. But
well, these guys don't. They like to shoot the place up. But what's happening, Yemen is actually, you know, this war has been going on for years. And things are very confusing in Yemen because there's barely any government. The U.S. set up a puppet government, as you properly noted there, first under Mr. Saleh and then Mr. Hadi. But they're stooges. And just like the Afghan leader who's in Washington this week, same thing. But they everything is done by tribes and clans in Yemen. And I remember during the Yemeni civil war years ago, the royalists who were supported by the Saudis, this is back in the 60s, I think, or 70s, had surrounded the capital, Sana'a, and they issued an appeal, surrender or die. And the Republicans, who were supported by the Egyptians, looked like they were going to die. But then by the next morning, it was the royalists who had been defeated and were on the run, and the Republicans were triumphant. So you never know what's going to happen in Yemen.
Yeah, it sounds like a pretty wild and crazy place. And it used to be divided. South Yemen was ruled by the socialists at one point. Is that right?
That's correct. Well, South Yemen was a British colony, Aden. And then when the British left, the South Yemeni set up their own country. They were very left-wing. And they were busy fighting to the east in the desert region, running up to Oman, the Radfan region. And Oman is a British intelligence protectorate. It's been run by MI6 since anybody can remember. And the British SAS, secret commandos, were sent into Radfan to fight the Yemenis. Oh, lots of dashing fun and games, late Victorian sort of boys' fun. North Yemen was run by a nationalist regime, but its president agreed to hold peace talks with the South Yemenis, who sent a delegate, and the delegate opened his briefcase, and there was a bomb in it, blew them both up. So that's what you call Yemeni peace talks.
Yeah. All right, now, as far as the Saudis go, I didn't think they had an army other than the U.S. Army does all their fighting for them. So what army are they going to invade Yemen with?
Well, quite right. They used to rent the parts of the Pakistani army to protect them from their own loving people. The bombings around Sana'a today ascribed to the Saudi Air Force were probably done by the U.S. Air Force, flying out of Saudi Arabia and out of Djibouti, just across the Red Sea. The other Arab air forces are inconsequential. So, but again, it's us, Big Brother, pretending to be Saudis.
All right, now, so what do you make of this grand coalition that they've announced that's going to fight? I think they even have a name for it. I forgot, but. But they're saying that, the Libyans, even like they don't have their own problems. I don't know. The Libyans, every Sunni kingdom in the region are all invading Yemen. Now, that's just got to be PR, right?
Oh, yeah. It's just typical Arab baloney and bluster. And everybody makes big promises. We will march to Sana'a. We will liberate them from the filthy Houthis. Now, the Houthis, by interest, are allegedly backed by the Iranians. But the Houthis now are not pure Shiites. Well, they're an offshoot of the Shia movement. They're Zaydis, and they believe there are only five caliphs, whereas the regular Shiites believe in 12. So there's a doctrinal difference between the two. And it's quite significant, and they're kind of wild. But don't confuse the Zaydis with the Yazidis, who are in Iraq, who we have been rescuing from ISIS. Yazidis, Zaydis, it's a mess.
Oh boy, it sounds like one. And now, so, you know, obviously, TV and the neocons would have it that anybody in the Middle East who is a Shiite and has a gun is the servant of the Ayatollah. To what degree is that true? I mean, I guess I imagine that the Iranians would be crazy to not try to help their sort of co-religionists, no? Huh?
Well, Scott, I haven't seen any signs from afar of deep Iranian involvement in this. And the Iranians are trying to play good and make nice now to the United States because they want to conclude these nuclear negotiations. So they don't want to kick a hornet's nest in Washington. But, you know, we've seen this before with the communists in the 60s and 70s. Anything going wrong? Oh, it's the commies. It's the Reds under our beds. Now it's the wicked Iranians coming. And by the way, you know, as a longtime Middle East watcher, Scott, I have the uncomfortable feeling that this alleged conflict between Sunnis and Shias was largely caused by us. That was the plan in Iraq. That was General Petraeus's big idea, that they were going to take these two long divided but cooperating communities and attack them and bomb them and provoke them until they began killing each other. And that's just what happened in Iraq. And now I fear it's spreading across the Muslim world.
Yeah, they called it the El Salvador option. We'll hire the Badr Brigade to hunt down and kill all the leaders of the Sunni insurgency. And, you know, I just read this quote last night. I had forgotten about this. And now I don't even remember where I was reading it anymore. But anyway, it was the quote was from Paul Wolfowitz, that anytime anyone said, hey, man, you know, since the Sunni insurgency against American/Shiite rule is growing up, maybe we should talk to these guys and try to figure out some kind of modus of anything. He said, no, they're Nazis. They're Nazis. We can't side with them. And so he continued to simply serve the Iranians and their sock puppet factions and creating a horrible civil war that killed 1 million people there. And, of course, continues to rage to this day. And now Cypress Hill is playing, and that means we got to go to break. But we'll be right back with the great Eric Margolies right after this, y'all. EricMargolies.com. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, you guys, we're talking about the absolute mess in Yemen with Eric Margolies. Let's see if we can count some factions here. Eric, we got the Houthis, who've now taken the capital. We've got Saleh, the former president. We've got Hadi, the current president, who's on a boat out in the ocean somewhere right now hiding. And we got Al-Qaeda guys, who their movement has grown by 1,000,000% since Obama started drone bombing them, which is like, you know, adding water to little sea monkeys or something. And all these groups are fighting. And it's funny, you know, they keep talking about trying to rehabilitate Al-Qaeda in Syria, the Al-Nusra Front. If they could only convince these guys to publicly renounce Zawahiri, they'll start calling them the moderates. I wonder if they're going to, since the war party, the Israel First war party in Washington, D.C. hates the, Shiites the most, no matter what. I wonder if they're going to go ahead and christen Al-Qaeda in Yemen as moderate so that they can back the suicide bomber head choppers against the Houthis. What do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty confusing, and it's certainly going to stress out our poor congressmen and senators who are challenged to find Yemen or anything else on the map.
Right.
Let's add ISIS, which will undoubtedly stick its head up in Yemen. It already claims to have done so. And ISIS may be fighting Al-Qaeda. We don't know. It's awfully confusing. And we're not even sure, in fact, that these Houthis, whether the Houthis are a tribe or whether they are a religious group that started, got riled up after the U.S. started bombing their region in North Yemen in the 1990s at the request of the Saudis. It's very complicated. And I tell you, I think the U.S. is really bitten off more than it can chew in Yemen.
Well, now, at least the Saudis share a border there, so you think it must be likely, right, that with American AWACS and ships offshore coordinating the thing, that the Saudis, you know, should be able to march on the capital and have their way there, right?
Well, the Saudi military forces are pathetic. and they don't trust their own army. They don't want to give ammo to their army because they're afraid the army's going to turn around and overthrow the Saudi dynasty. The exact same thing happened in 1958 in Iraq. I hope my dates are right. In Iraq, where the British puppet ruler, King Faisal, and his advisor, Nouria Said, ran a dictatorship there for the British, such as we have in Afghanistan today. And the soldiers said, listen, nobody's ever fired a bullet in the army. Please give us bullets so we can go and liberate Palestine. Well, so they gave each soldier 6 bullets. They marched out of town, came back in, overthrew the king, hanged him from a lamppost, or Nouria Said was hanged from a lamppost too, and took over under the leadership of crazy Colonel Qasem. So this shocked the hell out of the Saudis, and ever since, they've never given ammo, serious ammo, to their army, and they keep a parallel military force called the White Army in Saudi Arabia, made up of loyal Bedouin tribes, advised by American security advisors from different military corporations.
But they're really just kind of an internal Gestapo for keeping the kingdom safe rather than being able to take on any outside force.
That's right. I'd be very surprised. It's a major logistics operation to mount an invasion of Yemen. Yemen is a very mountainous, rugged country with lousy roads and... Well, the Saudis might get as far as Sana'a, the capital, or Taif, but how are they going to supply them? The Americans would have to be deeply involved in this operation.
What, meaning American ground forces?
Well, certainly American, we don't have ground forces anymore. We only have advisors and counterterrorism forces. And, yeah, they would be, maybe the Pakistanis will be bribed to, you know, send some troops and advisors. They have a crack army, very efficient.
They are named as one of the members of the coalition here, the Pakistanis.
Yes, yeah, along with Freedom and Heroic Sudanese and the Moroccans. And what a joke this is. I love our American-built coalitions. There's one giant, us, and a whole bunch of little pygmies running around his fate so that we can call it a coalition. And it's faithfully echoed by our media, coalition forces today, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, then, so there's no faction that could possibly be loyal enough and strong enough to be bought off to serve America and its interests in this, it sounds like you're saying.
Well, I'm sure Washington will find some Yemenis who want to work for the Yankee dollar. They did with this Hadi president and his bunch of people.
Right, but will any of them be able to get the work done rather than just cashing the checks?
That's a very good question. The Egyptians may get involved too. You know, Egypt is offering itself, which has a 450,000 man army, offering itself to both the Saudis or its new paymaster and to the U.S. to take on dirty jobs that the U.S. doesn't want to do. So we can't exclude Egypt might intervene. As I mentioned earlier, it did under Gamal Abdel Nasser, who sent troops in there to support the Republican forces in Yemen who were being attacked by Saudi-backed groups. So it's a long story. It goes way back to the 60s.
Yeah. And now, as far as American intervention in Yemen so far in the last, you know, few years, Jeremy Scahill had a great report in The Nation. And let's see, Blowback. That one was Blowback in Somalia. I'm trying to remember the name of the thing. But he really had a great one about Yemen, about how all of the weapons that they had given to the Saleh government for use against al-Qaeda ended up being turned against the Houthis and whatever other domestic enemies that the Saleh government had. And then the whole thing turned out to be counterproductive. All it ended up doing was making everybody he opposed more powerful. The same old equation since 2002 or whatever. Every time you kill one of these guys, you create 10 more. And, You know, it just seems like that's the same kind of policy they're continuing to follow here. They don't know what else to do other than continue to pour weapons. In fact, they're saying they've lost $500 million worth of guns and tanks and trucks and God knows what to God knows which enemies over there, too.
That's right. That's simply astounding. You know, that's a court-martial offense. It's incredibly stupid. We've lost hundreds of billions of dollars in Iraq that were stolen. Big, you know, plane loads full of $100 bills that just vanished. And now we have all these weapons who eventually will be used against our troops or our local stooges, no doubt.
Yep. All right. Well, there's music. We're all out of time again already, but thank you very much for your time, Eric. I sure appreciate you talking about this with us.
Pleasure as always, Scott.
All right. Enjoy the rest of your vacation, sir.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. That is the heroic Eric Margulies. EricMargulies.com, spelled like Margolis. Also, he's at LouRockwell.com and Unz.com, U-N-Z, Unz.com. We'll be right back with Will Grigg in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I've got the heroic Will Grigg from Pro Libertate. That's freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. What in the world? A felon for a Facebook post? What is this? Welcome back to the show. Will, how are you?
Scott, I'm doing well, and I want to point out that we're dealing in this story with somebody I would consider an authentic hero, which is a designation I think is appropriate to Matthew Townsend. He's a cop blocker, peace activist, Ron Paul partisan, something of a gadfly at large, and he's made himself a perfectly commendable nuisance to the powers that be in Meridian, Idaho. And this is a story that I think demonstrates a principle I've called scalable totalitarianism. And it's the sort of a story that confirms our intuitive understanding of the depths of viciousness that are routinely limbed by the police state, even in a town as unexceptional as Meridian, Idaho. He was on a street corner, on a sidewalk, at an intersection on the 2nd of February in Meridian, dressed as the Grim Reaper, which is one of the costumes he affects from time to time when he's conducting street protests. He was holding a sign, a protest sign, in front of what I refer to as the oxymoronically named Liberty Tax Service. And Liberty Tax Service, as you've probably seen, often employs people to stand in front of their buildings wearing a costume of the Statue of Liberty, and Matthew apparently decided to wear something that was more suitable and more honest. He believes the principle of truth in advertising. So this sign on one side said that taxation does not equal liberty, and on the other side it said taxes fund terrorism, both of which, of course, are incontestably true. A police officer, and I want his name to be circulated far and wide. I want it to become the worst kind of famous. Officer Richard Brockbank of the Meridian Police Department pulled up to Matthew Townsend when he was on the sidewalk and accused him of blocking the intersection, which, of course, he hadn't been doing. And in the course of a conversation that lasted a couple of minutes, Officer Brockbank tried to get Matthew to admit to doing this. And Matthew, of course, refused to, first of all, because he hadn't. Second of all, because he knows that the standard investigating protocol for the Meridian Police Department is for the police to bully and browbeat and occasionally physically to beat people into confessing crimes that they may or may not have committed. That's the only way that they can go about solving crimes in the city of Meridian, apparently, including crimes of their own manufacture. And at various points during this encounter, Officer Brockbank asked Matthew Townsend for his ID. He didn't have it with him. Matthew supplied him with his name and his address. And these, of course, were well known to the Meridian Police Department because of Matthew's activities as a cop blocker. And he conducted various field sobriety exercises and so forth. He's trying to build the stop, trying to find an excuse to arrest Matthew. At one point, Matthew became surfeited with this officious and bullying behavior and said, "Listen, charge me with a crime or let me go." At that point, the officer fell silent, and so Matthew shrugged his shoulders and hit the button on the crosswalk and started across the street. legally using the crosswalk for its intended purpose. At that point, Brock Bank screamed out, "I'm not done with you," and then he called for backup, and on the other side of the street, he arrested Matthew Townsend for resisting and obstructing, which is to say, for exercising his legally protected right to cut off a contact with a police officer who has not charged him with an offense. So he was scheduled for a pretrial hearing a week ago today, Thursday, the 19th of March, and the eve of this hearing.
Wait, stop for just one sec. When he got across the street and the cop said, "Hey, hold it right there," or whatever, did he then fight the cop, or he put his hands out, "Go ahead and cuff me," or what happened then?
He submitted to the arrest, which is something that he is required by what the state calls the law to do, but which is not required, as we've pointed out on a couple of occasions, by common law. If you're being subjected to an unlawful arrest, according to Black, Bad Elk versus U.S., you actually have the right to resist up to and including the use of lethal force if your life is being threatened. But acting as a peace advocate and as a believer in non-confrontation where possible, Matthew submitted to this patently unlawful arrest. He didn't resist in any way. He did not fight. He did not flee. He did not object. He simply shut his mouth and submitted to this act of criminal violence by Officer Richard Brockbank and two officers who have yet to be identified. So there's no predicate for the arrest. There was no resisting or obstructing involved in the actual execution of the arrest. He was booked. He was given $300 bond, which he paid, and he was released on his own recognizance. And so he had a pretrial hearing a week ago in Meridian, actually at the Ada County Courthouse in Boise. The Meridian City Attorney's Office contracts all of its prosecution to the Boise City Attorney's Office. And so they have a very young law school graduate working as an assistant city prosecutor by the name of Abby Germain, who represented the city of Meridian in this proceeding. The night before the pretrial hearing, Mr. Townsend posted a notice on his Facebook page that if the case were not dismissed, which of course it needs to be, and if the charges were not dropped as they should be, that he would conduct what he called a shame campaign, which would target Officer Brockbank and those in his professional circle who are responsible for doing what they did to him. So when he shows up for the pretrial hearing last week, his court-appointed public defender says that he just that day, just within the last few minutes of this encounter, had received notice that they intended to arrest him at the courthouse on a complaint that he had been engaged in this intimidation of a state's witness. And so there was a pretrial hearing on the resist and obstruct charge, and after that business was concluded, Germain announced to the judge, James Cawthorn, that the state intended to move to revoke Matthew's bond and to file a new charge, a felony charge, through the Ada County Prosecutor's Office for the crime of felonious intimidation of a state's witness, specifically the heroic, intrepid, valiant, badass Richard Brockbank, who, despite the fact that he goes to work accoutred in every variety of implement of lethal violence and the pain infliction, and he wears body armor, and he's clothed in this impregnable shield called qualified immunity. Notwithstanding all of this, and the fact that Meridian, of course, is part of the same pool that gives us the Ada County Metro SWAT team, and they can call on these people for assistance when he finds himself imperiled. Notwithstanding all of this, he's such a timid, paling creature that a Facebook post promising to shame him supposedly would intimidate him from acting as a witness in the resist and obstruct trial, if indeed this goes to jury trial, as it probably will, of Matthew Townsend. Now, what happened in that hearing is quite interesting. Judge Cawthorn, and I've actually spent most of the morning doing a partial transcript of the audio recording of that hearing from last week. It's Judge Cawthorn. I'm mispronouncing his name. Forgive me. He refused to allow the state at that point to file charges. He set the matter for a hearing on March the 30th, and he required that the city of Meridian provide a motion to the defense attorney outlining its theory of the case and its evidence and such like that was supposed to be presented on this on Monday, the Monday of this week. And so he said, we're going to hear this on the 30th, at 10:30, and then he gaveled the matter shut. Now, that should have resolved the issue in terms of this spurious charge of felonious intimidation of a witness. However, the city of Meridian or the Ada County Prosecutor's Office, I've not been able to nail this down, they conducted an ex parte hearing, that is to say only a one-sided hearing with a different judge. They went judge shopping. They found a complacent judge. They filed a criminal complaint and an affidavit with that judge on that Thursday, and then they immediately put it under seal so we couldn't find out the details of it. And then the following night, after darkness had descended, while Matthew was getting sleep because he had to get up very early in the morning on Saturday to go to his job in the productive sector, he gets a knock on the door, and Ada County Sheriff deputies, three of them, show up and arrest him and drag him off to jail. And he's hit with a $25,000 bond on this perfectly spurious, felonious charge of intimidation of a witness. That was, as far as I can tell, I just barely got off the phone before talking to you, Scott, with a former assistant attorney general of the state of Oregon. And she confirmed to me that arrest was illegal because it violated an existing court order. So this is, I think, a really good example of Soviet-style criminal misconduct by police state operatives against a political dissident in the state of Idaho.
Yeah, boy, sure sounds like it so far, but boy, we got some follow-up questions on the other side of this break. Just you wait. It's the heroic Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with the great Will Grigg from freedominourtime.blogspot.com, the blog Pro Libertate. And we're talking about this case of Matthew Townsend being persecuted by the police in Meridian, Idaho. And, to sum up here, he was protesting on the side of the road, was arrested for no good reason. Other than the cop didn't like him, I guess. And then he posted, and here's the quote, reading from Will's post here at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. He says, I will begin, quote, I will begin a non-violent and legal shame campaign that will be remembered. Homeowners Association upsets protests in the aggressors' neighborhoods. Mailers, door hangers, online ads, local and hopefully national media. I've done it before and I can do it again, as well as other peaceful but annoying avenues will commence. Ooh, the terroristic threat implied in there. Can you believe? And so now he's being charged with a felony of attempting to intimidate a state's witness, the coward cop who arrested him in the first place. And now, let me make sure I understand you right, the way you tell this story here. Will, is it correct that the first judge said, oh, that's a bunch of crap, and wouldn't go along with it, and I guess either dismissed those charges or refused to allow them to be completely filed or however that works? And then, so they just went and found another judge, not of a superior level in the court system, but just another judge who said, yeah, no, this is fine. Go ahead and arrest him on this felony count of attempting to intimidate a state's witness with a declared intent to embark upon a very legal and peaceful shame campaign. Is that really right?
That's essentially what happened. I don't know who the second judge was. It would have had to have been a second judge because Judge Coffin had actually set the matter for a hearing on March 30th, and he had issued an order to that effect. So there's an existing court order here that restrains what can be done here. He actually had Matthew Townsend under his supervision on his own recognizance.
I see. So the judge hadn't dismissed the charge, but he had just said, you know, come back to me on this and that date, and then we'll work on this. And
yeah,
that wasn't good enough for them. They went and found a judge who would allow them to go ahead and arrest him on this charge now.
Let me read specifically what the judge said. I just transcribed it this morning.
Okay.
I'm concerned inasmuch as the allegation seems to be that Mr. Townsend has committed a new offense from the state's perspective. It's awfully difficult for Mr. Austin, that's the court-appointed defense attorney, to respond to that without knowing specifically what it is Mr. Townsend's accused of doing. In addition, Mr. Townsend would have certain constitutional rights in regards to any allegations of the commission of a new crime, and to place him in the position today of responding to those would be very problematic from a due process point of view. While it is concerning what the state is alleging, what I don't hear is any threats related to any type of physical harm, violence, things of that nature, to the officer involved in this case or his family. Certainly, I understand the concerns that the family members may have in this situation, not so much dealing with what you intend to do, Mr. Townsend, or what you meant to communicate. Until that hearing, what the court is going to do is I'm imposing a pretrial release order in your case, unsupervised conditions of the court. I'm not making you subject to the sheriff's office or anything like that. But what I am ordering pursuant to your attorney's reference today is I'm ordering you to untag the family members of the officer involved in the case. And then we'll come back on the 30th and have this hearing related to the state's request at that time. That was how the hearing ended a week ago in the Ada County Courthouse in Boise.
And you're saying that under the law, that's the end of that.
That's the end of that.
And you talked with this legal expert who said that they just have no authority whatsoever to go and find another judge to contradict that.
She expressed herself in a somewhat more pungent fashion than that, but that's the substance of what she said. And we're talking about somebody who's a former deputy attorney general of the state of Oregon.
Wow.
And so you're dealing here with a patently illegal arrest that was conducted under the cover of darkness for the intention of punishing and intimidating a conspicuous political dissident in Meridian, Idaho.
And doubly illegal because, as you write here, because they did it at night when they're forbidden from doing so under Idaho state law.
Yeah, after 10 o'clock, it's considered inappropriate barring exigent circumstances here. Now, if they want to concede that the mere prospect of being shamed is something that occasions such terror on the part of Officer Richard Brockbank, that's useful. It's useful, I suppose, to get some measure of the cowardice that we're dealing with here. This man has publicly admitted to being a coward. His officials, or his superiors in the Meridian Police Department, who apparently are the instigators of the criminal complaint and the warrant that was used to arrest Matthew Townsend, they're admitting that this officer is a coward, that he cannot withstand so much as public scrutiny of his actions, that he's somebody who will wither like tissue paper before a match in the face of public criticism of his actions. If that's all useful, of course, but the means they used to make this disclosure, which I appreciate, were patently illegal because they violated the existing court order by the trial judge.
Mm-hmm. And now, so what about the fact that the way I read this, it sounds like he accidentally tagged some family members of this cop in his Facebook post, and it kind of freaked them out.
This is actually something that was addressed by his defense attorney in that hearing as well, but he sent this out as widely as possible in an effort to make the message known to the public. What he said, and I'm quoting now, is he does not know the officer's family. He does not know where they live. He does not know if all the people he tagged were family members or not. They could be cousins. They could be kids. They could be his wife. They could be anybody with the same last name. And he tagged other people who weren't even involved with the family. He wanted to get the message out. That's all he was trying to do. That same post was tagged to every media outlet in the state of Idaho and beyond. So what he was doing was using whatever associative function exists in the Facebook algorithms to find if he could get this message to Officer Brockbank by tagging the last name Brockbank. So conceivably there are people throughout the blogosphere, not geographically limited to the state of Idaho or to the United States, who received this message, most of whom probably looked at it and said, that's interesting, but what does it have to do with me? But in order for this to be a true threat, this is something that's not been really hashed out so far in case law having to do with the Internet specifically. But in terms of the substance of what was said, for it to be a true threat, it has to be a statement regarding imminent criminal violent action. That is to say, he would have to not only be giving off these vaporous outbursts of frustration, but he would have to be articulating a specific set of actions that are violent and that are criminal. And the substance of what he said, the explicit statements that he made, forswore the use of any criminal means or any violent means. So this is not a true threat to begin with, by any definition, certainly not with respect to what we have in terms of the protected activities under the First Amendment. But the way that it was tagged was somewhat indiscriminate because of the expressive nature of what he was doing. That's something that his court-appointed attorney talked about at some length, and I was quite surprised and somewhat gratified to see that he was so impassioned in defending the First Amendment activities of Matthew Townsend as a gadfly, as an activist here. And Abby Germain, who is representing the city of Meridian, apparently was auditioning for a daytime Emmy by clothing everything that had been written in this Facebook post with the heavy insinuation that this man was somehow a megalomaniacal stalker who intended to do harm not only to the valiant Officer Brockbank, but to anybody he might care about, because presumably this guy with a protest sign is the villain in the scenario rather than the armed goon who threw him to the street and then took him away at gunpoint simply because he had been protesting and expressing a point of view peacefully on a public sidewalk and then using a public crosswalk after deciding that he would end an investigative contact because the officer didn't want to charge him. He didn't have the grounds to charge him with anything.
Yeah, but Will,
he's being punished for contempt of cop.
Yeah, but don't the cops have a point here that this isn't America, this is the homeland, and the Bill of Rights is a dead letter, and you're a slave, and you'll do what you're told, or you'll die?
That's
isn't that the law now?
That's an interesting point that you bring up, because in discussions regarding the resisting and obstructing charge, and this is something that I'm getting secondhand, so I'm not going to be reporting this as if it were an established fact, but apparently there were discussions about the nature of resisting and obstructing and the fact that Matthew hadn't done anything physically or violently to resist the officer, and that he had acted on his own volition to cut off the contact. That was something that would be within the discretion of a police officer to describe as resisting and obstructing. You see, they have discretion when they make a contact with you because there's a proprietary claim over your actions. This is essentially the same mindset that we had in the 19th century when slave catchers were dealing with slaves who were out without their master's permission.
Yep, there you have it, everybody. Hey, listen, go and read this great piece. It's at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, A Felon for a Facebook Post, The Abduction of Matthew Townsend by the Heroic Will Grigg. Thanks so much for your time again, Will.